The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. How are you keeping? I do hope you are very well this damp and somewhat colder Wednesday morning, though things are going to improve, I think, as the day wears on and certainly into the weekend. It's 9:05 on this Wednesday, the 10th of May, and we have another one for you that is packed to the brim with stuff to keep you informed and entertained. And just like we have all week, we want to see loads of your texts coming in, your messages coming in, your opinions. Every opinion counts, so get yours into us on whatever we're talking about or whatever you want to talk about yourself. The WhatsApp and text number, just to remind you at the top of the show, is 086 60 25000, and your calls come into us on 07491 25000, and emails also comments@highlandradio.com. Let's start with the Finn Valley Voice this morning as we have a quick run through what's making the papers today. In 2018, medics were unsure when or indeed if Michaela Breen would walk again. But on Thursday morning at Finn Valley AC, the inspirational convoy schoolgirl won a silver medal in the 800 metre race. This was about more than a race and a medal. 5 years ago, Michaela also medalled on the same blue and white track in Stranorlar in the wheelchair race. And she's pictured both in her wheelchair 5 years ago and recently winning that 800 metres silver. Congratulations to her. On to the Inish Times this morning. Defective blocks campaigners are urging Housing Minister Dara O'Brien to take the views of homeowners into account ahead of the publication of regulations for the enhanced redress scheme. Members of the Mica Action Group, as well as defective blocks campaigners from Limerick, Mayo and Clare, are due to have a virtual briefing with the minister today on the regulations for the so-called enhanced €2.2 billion scheme. We'll keep you updated on what goes on at that virtual meeting, of course, on this radio station. The Donegal Post this morning, a contractor for the building of 42 housing units, units at Drumacrin in Bundoran is expected to be announced within weeks, and they should be on site sometime in July, members of the Donegal Municipal District were told at their monthly meeting yesterday. Tara Quinn, executive architect, said that the letter of intent to the successful contractor had been issued, with insurances and bonds being checked before a formal appointment in the coming weeks and the necessary legal protocols being adhered to. That was broadly welcomed, as you can imagine, at that meeting. On to the Irish Times now, and Donald Trump's woes continue, have got somewhat worse. He's facing a whole host of litigation. But this could certainly have some impact on his bid to be the President of the United States. Again, a jury in New York has found former US President Donald Trump liable for sexually abusing and defaming a magazine columnist. However, the jury did not accept that he had raped her. The jury found that Mr. Trump should pay €5 million in total damages to the writer E. Jean Carroll, arising from both the findings of sexual abuse and defamation. The case in New York was a civil action rather than a criminal case. Mr. Trump will not face any criminal penalties arising from the jury finding. Legislation in New York allows for civil cases to be brought by alleged victims of sexual assault after the statute of limitations for criminal cases has expired. Ms. Carroll had alleged that she had been raped by Mr. Trump in the changing room of a department store in New York City nearly 30 years ago. The former president had strongly denied any wrongdoing and had alleged that the allegations against him had been made up by Ms. Carroll. However, Mr. Trump did not put up a defence and did not give evidence directly in the case, although he had suggested when in Ireland last week that he could turn up in court. And there was a video released in the last couple of weeks of his deposition as it relates to that case, where he was asked about various comments he had made in the past, and it was probably quite incriminating. I don't know, because maybe we're all a little bit peeved off with GAA at the moment, just with what's happening with the inter-county team, I don't know. But there hasn't been a massive uproar or conversation, has there, in Donegal and the Northwest as a whole, as it relates to the controversy about the televising or of games. Well, the GAA and RTE split a €1.1 million dividend on back of healthy profits from GAA Go long before it moved Saturday evening games behind a paywall, the most recently filed account show. As controversy around the streaming service intensifies, latest accounts for GEA Go show the joint venture was able to pay a dividend of $1.1 million on the back of healthy profits in 2021, even before the increase in pay-per-view games. This comes as Virgin Media questioned RTE's commercial partnership with the GAA. Now, this is messy. It said the GEA did not approach other broadcasters to see whether they were interested in broadcasting games after it existed or exited, the deal with Sky, the existing deal with Sky finished at the end of 2022 season. So we could be forgiven for thinking that this was the only show in town. But Virgin Media or any other broadcasters weren't approached to say, look, the deal with Sky is going here. Are you interested in it? Instead, it was just gifted to RTE. They were able to work with the GEA and come up with this scheme. When Sky Television decided not to renew its GEA rights, the GEA did not approach any other broadcasters, but arbitrarily decided to put them behind a paywall, Virgin Media said in a statement. Now, what I don't understand is that there are many other platforms RTE has to show games if there's a clash of games. So a big hurling game and a provincial final. I mean, stick it on the news channel. I think most people have access to the RTE news channel. You could show two games at the same time. There's no shame in that. Instead, they put a big hurling game that would enjoy an audience of between 250 and 400,000 people on pay-per-view effectively. And said there was no alternative. Well, there's an alternative for you. Stick it on the news channel. Stick the weaker game on the news channel. And most people, as I say, can access that or access it online, do it for free. Anyway, if you have a view on that at the moment, 086 60 25,000. Junior Minister Niall Collins has said publicly he absolutely knew his wife was interested in purchasing a piece of public land before it was raised at a local area meeting in 2007. This is in the Mail and other papers. Now, that was the final remaining question. One of the last remaining questions as it relates to this deal. In other words, at this local area meeting, it was decided that this land could go for sale. He was part of that process. And the question was, did he know at that point that his wife was interested in the land? When he said, yep, he didn't dissent or recuse himself. And he says, yep, we'll allow this land to go to sale. Mr. Collins was a councillor in Limerick, a section of public land in his local area of Patrickswell, received several expressions of interest, though we haven't really seen proof of these several expressions of interest. At a meeting of the Brough local electoral area council, it was proposed that the land would be sold, and this was seconded by another councillor. Mr. Collins was present at the meeting, and while he now says in hindsight he should have recused himself, which means effectively saying, look, I have an interest in this, I'm going to step out until such time as it's dealt with. That's really effectively what recuse means. He believes he did not break any law. Asked if his knowledge of his wife, Dr. Emer O'Connor's interest in purchasing the land represented a material interest in the matter, and therefore he should not have attended, Mr. Collins said that was his judgment at the time, which I think is remarkable. The local area committee does not have the power to sell land. This can only be done at a meeting of the full county council, but the county council, of course, can't consider it until such time as it is approved at that local meeting. So that rumbles on. I'm not sure if anything else will come from that. Do you think the moon landing happened? Honestly, we haven't really done it since we as a population, and I'm not one of these people really that subscribes to I don't know if conspiracy theories as such, but if you look at the yoke that is supposed to have landed on the moon, like, it's held together with tape and tinfoil. But anyway, if you do look at the footage, it's remarkable. And they can't really... And what I think really is quite interesting too, there was a recent smaller probe sent up to the moon, and it had the best brains and all the technology behind it, and they failed to actually be able to land it. Yet this thing, this mishmash of 1960s technology, was able to land on the moon. They got out, had a walk around, got out and flew back. Now, I'm not saying it didn't happen, all right, but there's an awful lot there that would make you wonder, did it or did it not happen? But anyway, the reason I mentioned it is because it's in the Star today. Russia has tried to spark real-life Star Wars by claiming the US never landed on the moon. Dmitry Rogozin, the former head of Russia's Roscosmos Space Agency said he did not believe astronaut Neil Armstrong made one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind in 1969. He claimed he'd spent the past 10 years studying Armstrong's historic Apollo 11 missions, but had found no documentary evidence of the Americans winning the space race. The Russian former deputy prime minister also dismissed five subsequent lunar landings in which American astronauts also walked on the moon. In a post on social media website Telegram, Rogozin said he did not believe any of them had made it. He said, "It was not clear to me how the United States, at that level of technology developed of the 60s of the last century, did what they still cannot do now." So as to say, I mean, I'm not backing the Russians on this, but if you look at it, and if you have a close look at the ship that did land the first one, it doesn't look fit for it. But anyway, what do you think? 086 60 25,000. In the Sun today, weight loss jabs also boost protection against cancer, a new study shows. The treatments such as Wegovy and Ozempic were found to help restore the body's natural killer cells, which can fend off and destroy tumours. Being obese or overweight reduces the body's defences against cancer, as vital cells are rendered useless. Irish researchers studied the effect of the weight loss drugs, active ingredients, on 20 obese people. They found that after 6 months of the weekly jabs known as GLP-1s, the body's killer cell function was recharged. Professor Donal O'Shea of the Irish Health Service Executive said our findings represent very positive news for people living with obesity on GLP-1 therapy. So I'm not sure if that's relevant to you, but anyway, might be some useful information. And finally, in the Irish Daily Mirror, Wild Youth, they did all right last night. I don't think the lead singer followed the rehearsals because the cameras were all over the place in trying to track his running around. And in fairness, he didn't seem to sing that much. But that being said, Wild Youth did really well last night. But they were left devastated after Ireland again failed to qualify for the Eurovision Song Contest Grand Final for a fifth year in a row. Conor O'Donoghue, wearing a gold jumpsuit and green shamrock necklace, was surrounded by pyrotechnics as he delivered the song's vocal climax. But despite giving it their all, Wild Youth lost out on the first semi-final last night in the M&S Bank Arena in Liverpool. There was no comment from Wild Youth afterwards, with disappointed Conor leaving the arena as voting concluded and the results became clear. And we're going to speak to someone who was at it last night. There was some very weird acts that got through. I'm not really sure what it's about anymore. I don't think there's any point sending someone over there that can sing or whatever, because it's just, there was a couple of acts in particular that were absolutely crazy. But there was a couple that were pretty good and they got through. Anyway, be that as it may, I'm not able to watch it on Saturday anyway, so no loss. But a shame for the guys, because I thought they did really, really well. Okay, let us take a quick break. If you want to comment on that or anything else, by the way, get in touch with us. And just a reminder, if you want to watch the show as well, get on to our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, across our Facebook pages, Highland Radio News and Sport, and just Highland Radio. Comment and interact with us there. Good morning to Stephen and Paul, who are already with us, and the rest of the crew watching across all the channels. Now, the government is being warned that the proposed sale of alcohol bill could come at enormous cost to Irish society. An analysis of the bill published today points out that the extension of trading hours, along with the removal of limits on the number of licences, will cause increases in alcohol-related disease and violence. Professor Tom Babber is author of the report, The Sale of Alcohol Bill 2022, An Analysis of Costs and Benefits, and he joins us now. Professor, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's very good to have you on the programme. Okay, so talk to me a little bit more about these findings and how you came to these, how this report came to these conclusions.
Well, the sale of alcohol bill, excuse my voice.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, the sale of alcohol bill is supposed to simplify things, which is good. And it's supposed to help with the nighttime economy, which isn't bad. But there are lots of other things that are implicit in the bill that are somewhat disturbing from a public health perspective. And that goes with not only expanding the number of licenses, but facilitating home deliveries and increasing the density of outlets and attracting large numbers of people to the central cities and towns. When you put all that together, it's a prescription for the possibility of epidemics of heavy episodic drinking, which is people going out and getting drunk. And that is not necessarily a good thing, particularly for young people. It's not a good thing for the nighttime economy either. So what we're talking about is excess noise, underage drinking, people drinking on the streets, going from one bar to the other, bars catering to heavy drinkers by not allowing people to sit down, vertical drinking bars where they stand up all night and people walk around letting them drink shots. All of these things have been tried and found to be detrimental in other cities, in the UK, Leeds and Manchester, Amsterdam. Australia has had serious problems. We've got a lot of examples and we've got a lot of research that shows the higher the density of the outlets and the more alcohol that's available, the more people get drunk.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously you have to be careful with your language in that you talk about the possibility. I mean, really, it's an inevitability. And I think too, particularly having access to alcohol, I mean, it already happens where there are people that drive around with booze in the back of cars and deliver it to homes and what have you. That's just one element of it. And also too, where did this come from? I mean, I haven't met anybody in the public who has been calling for this or wanting this, a liberalisation of these rules, when we see other countries actually really becoming a little bit more conservative in terms of alcohol consumption.
Right. So I'm not familiar with the political situation in Ireland, but it seems like the development of a plan like this, a piece of legislation, came from the Justice Department, but there wasn't consultation with children and families. It wasn't consultation with public health, emergency departments, hospitals, police. All of them need to be heard from, because I'm sure they're going to have strong opinions based on past experience.
And how did you, when you talk about the findings of this report, how do you conclude a lot of the findings? Is it based on, as you've been outlining there, the experience in other countries? And you mentioned a lot of them, so there's a wealth of information out there. I mean, a lot of it is of course, common sense. But how do you provide evidence for some of this stuff in terms of, you know, the likely increase in alcohol consumption and alcohol-related harm, for an example?
Yeah, it goes far beyond opinion, far beyond common sense. There is now a literature, a scientific literature, published in peer-reviewed journals, which means that the studies have been conducted carefully by reputable social and behavioral scientists to measure the effects of both expanding alcohol availability and outlet density and restricting alcohol availability and outlet density. And the research shows predictable changes when you either increase availability or reduce it. We're talking about hundreds of studies conducted in a variety of different countries.
And it's not only two either, I suppose, the impact it has on people. If you are going to go down this route, presumably the entire infrastructure has to change as to how you deal with it in terms of, you know, what kind of security is required, what level of policing there is, you know, what kind of public transport or private transport is available, the consequences it might have in terms of drink driving or collisions on the road on EDs. I mean, you know, if what it's likely to happen, what you say is to happen, it's the knock-on effect and the infrastructure that also would have to change around it to accommodate it. It's a massive change in how people socialise and consume alcohol.
Yeah. In the UK and Australia, city officials and national officials have been working for years now to reverse the negative health impact of expanding the nighttime economy. And we know from their experience that there are a number of things that could be built into the Irish legislation that would minimize the harm. We don't need to expand the number of licenses. We need to make sure that off-license outlets that are selling alcohol are not open all night, so we need to restrict them as well. We need to do things like providing communities with legal resources so they can comment on expanding the number of pubs in their neighborhood. We can provide further restrictions on training of people who own a license, and to make sure that they're not overselling and pushing alcohol. So home deliveries need age verification so kids aren't getting access to alcohol. So there's a lot of things that could be done.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, it's a very interesting report. A lot of it, I think, is incredibly likely to happen, as well as other as well consequences we have yet to fully discover. But for now, Professor Tom Barber, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Take care. He is an author of that report, The Sale of Alcohol Bill 2022. And just in relation to the impact potentially on emergency departments, a recent study in emergency departments, 29 of them across Ireland, found that alcohol accounted for 6% of all patients presenting. So alcohol, a factor in 6% of all patients presenting at emergency departments, which is really quite significant, isn't it? 57% arriving by ambulance of that cohort. In the early hours of a Sunday morning, alcohol-related illness and injuries accounted for 29% of all presentations. That's almost a third of people that turn up on a Sunday in the ED. It's to do with booze. And 6% of all patients, it's alcohol-related, and over half of that 6% must arrive by ambulance, which, as I say, is really not insignificant, is it? Right, OK. Mary Lane joins us on the programme now. Hi, Mary Lane.
Good morning. This is Liverpool calling.
Yes. Can we have your vote? So Ireland, no points because we don't get through to the grand final.
We didn't, but they did so well. I'm so proud of them. They were fab.
Yeah, talk to me about the show. It looked like an amazing spectacle. I have to say, I think they did really well in terms of the stuff they presented to recognise the situation in Ukraine. Obviously, Liverpool hosting this. I'll ask you about that first. Liverpool hosting this because Kyiv clearly can't. How did that stuff come across in the audience?
I spent the first 5 minutes actually bawling, crying, like proper ugly crying. I was so full of emotion. The piece that was, that you could see on the TV, the little boy, the little story, and I looked over at the stage and I could see the little boy on the stage ready for his cue, and oh my God, I just burst out crying. This is just so beautiful, and everybody was just loving it, and everyone was so respectful in the room because they told us in advance, you have to, you know, at the start, everybody has to be totally silent. If anybody makes noise beside you, just thump them to make them be quiet. And, you know, you could have heard a pin drop in the room. It was outstanding. And then, obviously, when we got our cue to roar, the place just, I mean, you could feel it in your chest. Just, the atmosphere was something else.
All right, so why did Wild Youth not make it through? This was a public vote, and for the first time, people all around the world could vote, except our neighbours in Britain couldn't vote. But the song was good enough, wasn't it? The performance was good enough. It was camp enough. It was loud enough. There was plenty of pyrotechnics. There was some strange acts that went through, really, I think, ahead of us.
Yeah, and so they went Croatia, got the first. Getting through, you could hear it in the room, people going, what? But, you know, for me, I'm a massive Eurovision fan for 30 years. I live and breathe it at this time of the year. And I think the fact that it was only a public vote, popularity got the better of people. It's the stronger of the two semi-finals, in my Eurovision opinion, it was a stronger semi-final than Thursday's.
Yeah.
So it was a much tougher competition. I think had it been a band of jury and a popular vote, the jury may have evened the keel a wee bit, and we may have got through. But in my own opinion, is that we were in the grey area, re-qualified, but we might not. I wasn't coming to thought, but we're definitely going to get through. I always knew it was a grey area somewhere; it could go either way. But I don't think enough was done, by the Irish contingent to promote it enough and to really get in with the whole social media thing. I don't think Ireland has moved with the times in terms of how Eurovision is done anymore.
The line, Mary Lane, is absolutely... The line is awful. I'm going to stick with it just for the time being. I wonder, with the culture wars that are going on at the moment, and we've seen brands like Bud Light being pretty much wiped out because they took the wrong stance, as some might see, on certain issues. Do you think the trans controversy played out and worked against the lads, I wonder?
I'm not sure, because I'm actually not sure that news made it too far outside of Ireland.
Right.
Do you know, no one's talking about it. No, I haven't seen too much on social media about it outside of the Irish news sources. I don't think that was as big a thing as it may have been within Ireland. But it's a story that I actually nearly missed myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it was as much of any sort of scandal internationally as maybe what we think it may have had the potential to be. I just think we just in general didn't get on ball with promoting and immersing. I mean, Eurovision publicity is absolutely immersive. If you're not out there every minute of every day garnering the fans, it's not, it's just that you're just not going to. I don't think you're going to get very far just because you happen to have a good song and you like, it's a nice song or it's a worthy winner. You have to get on board with the overall thing. I just don't think RTE have got there yet.
Right.
I just don't think they're putting enough time and effort and energy into side of things. But I come to it with it. As long as we do ourselves proud performance-wise and actually put a good song in, you can say, at least give it a good shot. Not to sound unpatriotic, it doesn't bother me whether they get through or not, because I just love the whole thing of just the culture of it. I love seeing people from all over the continent and the language and hearing our music from all other parts of the continent. I think it's just a fabulous celebration, and I wish the controversy of all sorts of things would.
Well, let's just not
because
worry about
the fans that were in the room.
Yeah, come here. What was the Croatia like live? I mean, that was something else. That was. I mean, I don't know. And Moldova as well was all. I don't know.
I have to say, in my hotel room here, we're Moldova fans, and we like the Croatian one. Definitely, I don't think it should have got through. But then, it's actually going to make for good entertainment on
Saturday
night.
Finland seemed to absolutely rock the house with their track, Cha Cha Cha. What was that like live?
It was amazing. And I will be a bit annoyed if it does win, because I think there are worthier winners, there are better songs in it. But in terms of entertainment factor and absolute game of the Laldi. The fabulous and Finnish fans here are amazing. You can spot a Finn from a mile away.
Okay.
They're all walking around in their fluorescent green puffball posts. They're amazing. And everybody here is fantastic. And Liverpool, oh my God, I can't commend Liverpool anymore. They're fabulous. It's a beautiful place to be. They have gone all out on Eurovision from the second you step off the plane. The place is Eurovision Central. It's outstanding.
Right. Okay. You chatted to the lads afterwards. What were they? What was the mood like? I think you got chatting to the drummer.
I got speaking to the drummer afterwards, and like they're gutted. And you know they were fairly well oiled now by the time I got chatting to them. But I told them how proud we are and that they should be proud of themselves and that they did such a good job and they did us proud in their performance and their delivery and everything. And we were at a distance because he was still in the delegates area, whereas I was kind of, you know, there was a couple of metres of a difference. We were kind of shouting across to one another.
Yeah.
And he just said, oh, I wish I could come over there and give you a hug. Wow. So I peer stand for a selfie. So he climbs up on top of the barrier and takes a selfie. So I'm so proud to have seen Ireland live in Eurovision. For me, it's 30 years in the making.
All right, brilliant, Mary.
Brilliant experience.
And I love your enthusiasm. And that's what it is. It's about a bit of fun. There's enough serious stuff going on in this world. At the moment.
Oh, yeah.
So let's have a bit of fun with it. Thanks, Mary Lane. Have a lovely time over in Liverpool. We're also joined on the programme now by Gary. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Greg. How's it going?
Not too bad at all, Gary. Did you watch it last night?
I did, Greg. I did watch it from start to finish, but very disappointed that Ireland didn't get through.
We deserved it, didn't we? We deserved to get through.
Exactly, and I thought it was actually a great song.
Yeah.
And they put on a great performance, so I'm just kind of baffled as to why they didn't make it through.
Well, when you see Serbia and, getting through, I mean, Serbia, I don't know, it's just, I didn't think it was a very strong song. And we mentioned some of the others that got through as well. I mean, there were some good songs. Norway, I thought, a good Eurovision song. You like Sweden, like myself, Sweden. I mean, that performance was astonishing too. That's a pop. That's a proper pop song, isn't it? That will do
incredible.
Very well.
Personally, I think Sweden will win this year.
Yeah.
Because Loreen obviously won it back in 2012, I think. So. Mm-hmm. And an incredible performance and incredible voice.
Yeah, indeed.
But I realised the UK, actually, no one in the UK was able to vote last night.
No,
so it meant that nobody could vote for Ireland, which I find a bit strange, to be honest.
Yeah,
Greg.
Me too, because we could have done with those votes, couldn't we?
Exactly. And I think that maybe had a bearing on Ireland's exit, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
Because I was sure Ireland would get through.
Yeah.
And I don't know about the lads, but I was very disappointed myself. So I'm sure they must be devastated not to make Saturday's final.
That being said,
but that's the way it goes.
Yeah, and that being said, I suppose they get the publicity, they get the platform. They're already doing quite well. They're young, they're handsome. Myself and yourself won't cry too much for them. We won't cry too much for them,
will we? True enough.
Do you know what I mean? Okay, but did you watch on Thursday or did you watch last night just because of Ireland's involvement, Gary?
I watch both semis every year, Greg, and I always watch the final maybe with a few family members. So, but yeah, I'll be watching Thursdays as well.
All right, good stuff. I'll
definitely be tuned in for Thursday, and then obviously Saturday night there'll probably be a few beverages involved for Saturday night show.
Well, no bother. All right, then. Cheers, Gary. Thank you very much indeed for that. Right, okay. That was a quick take on the Eurovision. If you have any other views on it, 086 60 25000. Having watched Eurovision for 35 years and being a fan and Irish, I can say the song from Ireland and the band were weak. They performed well on the night, but you can't compare what we send with the likes of Lorraine from Sweden. We need to up our game and stop selecting on the Late Late Show. Yeah, do it a different way. But you see, is there any point taking it as a serious song contest? Shall we listen to some of the performances that were on last night? This is the Croatia people. It was very, very different. This is what got through for Moldova. suppose very culturally appropriate. This was a cracker from Switzerland. They might do really well too. This was the fan favourites on the night from Finland. Don't know how Chechi got through with this, but anyway, they did. Israel sailed through, no doubt. She's brilliant, though, in fairness. She is a proper pop star. Portugal always sends up the game very culturally Portugal, and they always seem to get through. And this is the song Gary was referencing from Sweden. Brilliant presentation on the night as well. Serbia. Don't know how they got through, but anyway. And the first song of the night from Norway. Very Nordic, very Viking-like. Tell you, Marty Whelan doesn't get a lockin'. There you go. All right, that was a run-through about the Eurovision last night. Most of you were probably watching Man City, Real Madrid. I don't even know the result, and I actually am a football fan as well. But anyway, I am reliably informed by people that did watch it that City likely will come through the second leg. All right, let's take a break. Okay, Tim Kelly, strategic head of TCS, Threat Management Centres in UK, Ireland and Europe. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I am fantastic. Great to have you on the show. Now, we're speaking off the back of a report which finds the Northwest region is attractive location for cybersecurity investment. So why particularly?
Well, there are a couple of reasons, right? One is that cost of living. Cost of living in Letterkenny, it's going up everywhere, but in Letterkenny, comparatively speaking, from metropolitan centres is lower, right? We've got a great base of talent. The TU consolidations, lots of master's programs, and a lot of good pipeline coming through. So, you know, TCS decided we'll put one of the 11 we have around the globe right here in Letterkenny.
Yep. So already 250 cybersecurity related jobs based here in the Northwest. That's only a fraction, though, of cyber professionals in the Republic of Ireland. That percentage could grow rapidly with the right investment then, so I'd imagine.
It would. You know, investment's required for all things that are hyper growth, right? And cyber jobs are no exception. You know, we see demand quadrupling over the short term, and the problem's not in demand, it's in supply, right? So the opportunity, like we always wait for, is there. It's just a matter of capitalizing it as quickly as we can.
Yeah, and these are good, well-paid jobs for the most part.
Yeah, cyber is a well-compensated and never been better compensated profession. And the jobs are all levels, entry level, medium term, senior positions. We have clients, we have over 20 global brands around the country here in Letterkenny already. And the demand's never been stronger.
Are we able to satisfy the demands for workers with the people that we are seeing qualify out of Ireland? I know, is that an area, do we need to be targeting maybe in schools to educate students that, you know, cybersecurity is a real good option with jobs available and to focus your third level in that area?
Yeah, we do. We do a lot of this activity, particularly in third level traditionally, but it's never enough and it's never early enough. Right. So we have a number of programs that we try to develop in secondary levels. We even did some primary level education just to, you know, help to balance the equation from a gender profile, from a, you know, diversification profile. Because the one thing you need in cyber is a real expansive exposure in the world.
Well, before we talk more about what kind of investment is required, where do you see the future of that? Because it's ever evolving, and I imagine the way we're seeing AI, you know, come to the fore now, and how it might be involved going forward. Will that create? Do you believe challenges, or perhaps even, you know, cybersecurity fighting opportunities for this sector? Where do you see? Because sometimes we talk about the next 5, 10, 50. This could be next year, really, that we're having to really adapt.
Like, it's, you know? It's great. I mean, it's funny that a lot of this generative AI has been in progress for years without substantive, practical, this can help me write an essay effect, right? So if you think of just of spam and phishing, right, which is I try to get Greg on the hook so I can invade his bank account. So those emails were never particularly well structured linguistically. Now they're great. So if you have an adversary who could pipe it through an AI, guess how much harder that is for the human being and the defensive systems to detect, right? So every development technology has really had a subsequent imperative for cybersecurity, right? As we get more technically sophisticated, we have to get better and we have to get it right all the time. And that has really changed a lot of the game that we work on.
Yeah. Okay. So where does money or need to be invested then, say, for instance, in this area here in the Northwest to potentially capitalize on the potential that there is?
Okay. So I'll give you an example, right? I just want to tell one quick story. So our global head of CSR was over just last week to celebrate one of our local students, Laura, who won a global IT competition, right? One of 40,000 students. And he was asked what he was doing at the World Economic Forum last week. And he said, Laura, I told the story about you, how we just need to get out of the way in order for the youth of tomorrow to be able to build that future, right? So the kind of investment we need is exactly that, in education, in OT, operational technologies and critical infrastructures. They all have embedded security. Your Alexa's at home, embedded security. The old FOSS, now SOLAS, if we had practical labs that physically built out to develop those skills in kids in electronics and machinery and robotics, we'd be a hell of a lot further along. Needless to say, the education initiatives and some of the recruitment needs to step up as well.
Yeah, but Tim, this sounds very much like the people that you're trying to speak to need to get this. They need to understand it. They need to buy into what you're cooking. Do you know that sort of a way?
That's correct.
Is that a struggle? Because you're really perhaps operating 5 or 6 years, if not more, ahead of the decision makers. You know, they need to trust people like yourself to say, no, this is what's coming. And if we need an expert or professional at this point in 5 years' time, now is when you need to be starting them on the conveyor belt.
Yeah, you're 100%. It comes from two prongs, right? The prong of helping parents and students and decide, and that cyber is amongst their career choices, right? But then there's also this, we try to get ahead of the technology curve, which has significant financial investment, which is never goes around far enough. And then we have the all-island aspects, right? We always talk about all-island approaches to this. There's an all-Ireland research center been in the proposal stages for ages. So imagine if we could bring to bear all that talent northwest, south of the border, north of the border, and a groundswell hub into that. We can really start to make an impact and bring a lot of these jobs because, quite frankly, pieces like TCS, we can't satisfy the demand. We just can't.
Yeah. What courses are available? I don't want to ask you specific courses. We could be here all day because I presume there's shared skills. But in other words, like, you know, where can people study and what do they need to study really for a career in cybersecurity?
Yeah, it's interesting because cybersecurity takes from all branches, right? Even the liberal arts. It's more about critical thinking than it is about anything and problem solving, right? The ATUs all have programs specifically in cyber. IT has always been a problem solving career choice. NWRC is just now starting a foundational degree north of the border in cyber. So there are programs abound that kids can take advantage of for choices. Even in the junior leaving cert, there's now an option for cyber. So those forces are coming to bear, but not nearly force enough to create the groundswell, right? We talk about gravity wells where you have a couple of anchor tenants like a supermarket that pull in and create the opportunity for the region. We at TCS Ireland try to bring all that from TCS to bear. So do the regional skills guys. So does Optum. So does Advantio. We're all trying to do our best. We just need more hands at the till.
I mean, it's amazing opportunities. Currently, I believe 30% of cyber roles in this region are filled by people from within the region. So that obviously is 70% that move here. I mean, with a quadrupling in the numbers and with the proper, you know, there's real diversification opportunities here as well for people who want to go into different paths and what have you. Okay, hopefully the powers that be take it on board, and we need to listen to people in the know. Tim, what do you see as the biggest cybersecurity threat over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, we've commissioned a lot of reports. One of the reasons we're on today is because we're part of the Cyber Ireland cluster, which has over 7,500 professionals, right? But if you talk about the challenges we all face, we talk about the efficiencies that our adversaries are creating, right? You talk about ransomware. Everyone's heard about ransomware. People lock up your PCs. Guess what? Those adversaries now are skipping locking up your computers. They're going in without letting you know, they're grabbing your data, they're pushing it outside your perimeters, and then they're saying, hey, just pay me, right? Because they don't want to maintain their software, they don't want to maintain the decryptors. Imagine all those business challenges we all have going native in the cloud and developing technologically, except your adversary is doing that as well, diversifying across countries. It's an unbelievable challenge. If you staple to that some of the AI stuff you referenced earlier, Greg, it's a pretty big hill to climb.
And it's a race, isn't it? Because, you know, the ransomware, holding something to ransom, very shortly, if not already, that's going to seem like labor-intensive and old-fashioned, like something from an old movie, right? So they're always looking to develop. Mm-hmm. It's a race, isn't it? How quickly, you know, you can shut off their access points, or how quickly they can develop new ones. It's going to be a constant race, and they've got the best brains in the world, and we need the best brains in the world.
And
as
they
defense.
Have state actors, right?
Yeah.
So we're individuals and companies, and that's why Europe and state agencies are banding together to take some of the lessons we've learned, are learning in Ukraine, to develop combinations of public and private partnerships, right? Because you need scale. You need to be able to develop these centers, and the more of these assets that we have in the region, the better off we are.
Right. Finally, in the last minute or so, there's exciting opportunities. There's no doubt. I don't know, maybe even someone who wants to reskill or has young people looking for opportunities. They would love them to be able to stay in the region and live and raise a family here, rather than feel they have to travel the other end of the earth just to get together a deposit for a house. So, you know, what speak directly to those people. What do they need, or should they be doing?
Right. You may think, because you're not an IT or a cyber person, that this is not for you. And I guarantee you, critical thinking, musicians, guitar players, all of you can skilled at piecing apart problems and putting solutions together. There are first steps you can take, tester courses, TCS in Cyber Ireland. We have education initiatives around. There's plenty of them online. Don't be daunted. You don't need to be a nerd rocket science to get into this thing. It's just not that. It is about saying what is and what is not a problem and needs to be looked at with greater inspection. And we all do that in our day every day.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. And great potential. Lovely to chat to you, Tim. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate the time.
Take care. No, and maybe it's going to inspire someone to go down that route and do very well for themselves, we would hope. Okay, that is the first hour pretty much in the bag. We're going to take a break now for the news and obituary notes. It's actually I'm a little bit early. I have time for a couple of texts here. I think Wild Loof, that youth made a mistake by sacking their choreographer, impacted on votes, I believe. I think it has the potential. Steve says, I feel so sorry for anyone who was watching the Eurovision nonsense, considering Real Madrid were playing Man City in a brilliant game. But some people think that's nonsense too, the amount of money in that sport and what have you. But anyway, listen, each to their own. I don't think anyone is stupid for watching the football. I don't think anyone is stupid for watching Eurovision. And I don't think anyone be stupid for switching the telly off and reading a book. It's whatever makes people happy is important, isn't it?